This podcast is brought to you by ORCHSE Strategies, an industry leader in developing innovative, sustainable approaches for protecting workers and the environment. And a big thank you for their sponsorship to the Pre-Accident Podcast. ORCHSE's main focus and passion is in fostering EH&S performance excellence in all their companies. When members participate in one or more of ORCHSE's 9 different specialized networks, or if they engage in one of their task force or working groups, something very special happens. The sharing of ideas frequently results in cutting-edge solutions that have practical applications immediately. For example, ORC has been at the forefront of efforts to create new approaches for fatal and serious injury prevention and has helped plan, conduct, and create conferences on human and organizational performance. If you're interested in learning more about the unique opportunities available through ORCHSE, please contact our buddy Linda Haney at 202-510-0509. Or if you'd rather pop her an email, it's linda.haney, linda.haney at ORCHSE.com. Now, let's listen to the podcast.
So other than that, and you're good? I mean, you're feeling good and everything's happy?
Absolutely.
Howdy, everybody. It's Todd Conklin, and this is the Pre-Accident Podcast. It's noon. High noon. Hey, it's good to have you on board. I hope everything's going great with you. Big podcast today. I probably should have been promoting this more. I didn't think about promoting. Maybe I'll do something. I'll put something on that LinkedIn thing and promote it. Because today is a Sydney Decker Day, and this is a really interesting podcast. I won't try to spoil it for you, but it rolls into something very, very... charming idea towards the end of the podcast. Let's just go with that. I'll try to not talk anything more about it until you listen, because then maybe you'll have an idea and it'll be sort of a surprise to you, because it was kind of a surprise to me. So be as surprised as I am, and you'll kind of hear in my voice that I'm surprised. How are things going in the podcast? Well, it's going to be interesting. Who knows? I'm really curious to see what the future holds for us as we sort of progress through all the things that the future does. I'm so excited for the holidays. You know, if you've listened to this podcast at all, that I'm a total digger of Thanksgiving. It's just the best holiday ever. It's got all the opportunities to be grateful and none of the weird agendas that are involved with gift giving. Oh, sure. You can get into weird stuff. There's no question. Anytime families come together, there are lots of goal conflicts and complexities that arise just because we're families. You know, you can pick your nose and you can pick your friends, but you cannot wipe your friends on the bottom of the couch, right? See, that's the difference. It's a challenge, but it's my favorite challenge of all. It's a great holiday, and I love December as well. No problems there. But I don't know, Thanksgiving, it's just a marvelous time to just be grateful. And that is a very valuable way to spend your time. Gratefulness is maybe the best way to use your time ever. We're going to talk today a bunch about justice, because Sydney Decker's revamp, his third edition of Just Culture, is out, and it's moved in a very, very, very interesting direction, and he'll build a pretty good case for it. But I know, because I've talked to you about it, I did a whole series of pretty serious events kind of in one little chunk of time, and I really came up with some pretty strong opinions on it, and I promise I'll talk to you more about it. I'm currently putting together a book on it, which I think this idea of restoring an organization's ability to do high-risk work better than they could do it before they had the event is very powerful. The thing that's powerful is that the notion of justice is very ethereal. It's quite a heady topic. There's no question about it. The way we get to that ethereal concept is through some very specific questions. And if we have retributive justice, then we ask questions that sort of assume there's a flaw and we're going to fix it. When we ask restorative justice, we look at who was hurt, and hurt is kind of a big word. They could actually be hurt. Unfortunately, our work has that, but also hurt or harmed by the event itself. The first victim, the second victim, the third victim. And you have a discussion that sort of moves you in that direction. And that's what we're going to talk about today. I won't talk much more other than to tell you I'm so incredibly glad you're listening to the podcast. I don't know if I tell you that enough. It's remarkable how large and impressive the crowd who listen to this podcast is and how important you guys are. And it's kind of humbling for me just to be a part of doing it. But I'm still having fun. It hasn't gotten obligatory yet. So maybe it won't either. I don't know. We'll see. So let me not just yammer on. Let's get to kind of the reason you're here. This is Sidney Decker, and he's going to talk to us a bunch about the notion of restorative justice.
So what I was noticing in my conversations with lots of people in various industries, Todd, was the dissatisfaction that many people felt, managers, but also practitioners, with the just culture models as they do the rounds today. There's a punitive streak to them, even though, or a retributive streak, even though they aren't badged that way. They're still organized around retributive questions, right? Who broke the rule, right, would be the first question. Now you got an answer to that question. Then you ask the second question, well, how bad was that?
Right? Yeah,
and then
we
have all kinds of just culture schemes out there that sort of supposedly allow you to pigeonhole how bad it was. Oh, it's an honest mistake. Oh, honest mistake. Oh, then we'll let them go, you know. Or it was, oh, no, this is risk-taking behavior. I mean, they do this every day, you know, this is risk-taking behavior. Oh, that needs a real slap on the wrist, you know. Or this is just clear negligence, right? And then it's a fireable offense, or it's, you know, we've warned you five times, you're still not washing your hands before touching the patient, or whatever it is. And so, and then on the basis of that pigeonholing, on the basis of deciding whether it was a, you know, really white or some type of gray offense, really black, really bad, we then append consequences and say, well, given that it was this, these are the consequences. And then we presume that that somehow creates justice by algorithm, right? Which is, I'm not saying that, you know, in a busy managerial life, it's stupid to try to follow that sort of algorithm and that sort of, you know, decision tool. I fully understand, and particularly given the role I currently have, that, you know, which we can talk about later, but that managers would want to rely on something like that. But the thing is a couple of things. One is managers still have to do the hard work, you know, because who's gonna really make the decision for you whether the behavior was white, gray, or black? You know, it's a judgment that you have to make, and that's still a really tough human judgment about human intentions, about the ideas, the goals, the constraints of other people. I mean, you have to make a judgment about that. No tool takes that off your hands.
The tool's so seductive to them. And I think it's seductive because the algorithm's easy to use, or in theory easy to use. But I think it's more seductive in the frame of justness, in that the algorithm can be fairly applied to all people all the time. I mean, I think that's I don't think it's true, but I think they see it as very seductive. I mean, they want to hardwire it into the HR policy, right?
And this is what all bureaucracies do, right? They want to make what the literature says is things synoptically legible, that is legible from all perspectives, right? And so commonly or equitably applied, no matter what your job, no matter what your background, no matter who you are, right? And that's the idea of Lady Justitia with the blindfold, right? So we're not looking at the person, we're just looking at the acts of the person. So where it goes wrong, where it goes off the rails, is in research showing that any retributive response to an error or a failure or an incident or adverse event, any retributive response has negative knock-on effects. And what are those typically? You shut people up. They stop talking. They just become smarter at hiding stuff from you. Or they may present you with such huge paper trails so as to prove that their intentions were good and that they really fit in the white side of those categories, right, rather than the black side, which means that it takes time and effort and attention away from their actual task, and you send them into liability management or accountability management preemptively, right? And we see this, for example, in defensive medicine, right? I mean, that's preemptive accountability management. Right, and it's expensive, it's stupid, and doesn't really help the patient, right? And so it really is about managing your liabilities. So the other one, and this is an interesting piece of research, shows that in organizations, typically those lower down the hierarchy find those schemes or algorithms less just than those at the top of the hierarchy, right? So the more power you have, the more just you consider these things to be. And I find that slightly worrying because ultimately, you know, and this is the whole basis for Western democracies, is we want justice over power, not power over justice, right? We want justice over power. And it seems to be the case that these sorts of algorithms get easily abused, right, by those who hold power and find ways to affirm that through the use, the supposedly legitimate use of these sorts of algorithms. And so, and again, it's not that I don't understand the struggle. It's not that I don't understand the need to respond to something that's gone wrong, because there's lots of stakeholders. You got eyes all over you, right? People are looking at, what are you going to do? You know, you got the regulator, you got the families, you got customers, you got investors, you got all kinds of stakeholders waiting for you to do something. And so if you don't act, you're not doing your job, right? So again, it's not that I have no sympathy. It's not that I don't understand. And that's where I wanted to develop an alternative and say, guys, there is a completely different way of thinking about justice. Rather than thinking about it retributively, we can think about it restoratively.
That's so powerful.
And you know what, Todd? There's a long and proud tradition of restorative justice over the past millennia. It's not some squishy, soft, sandal wearing 1970s invention. Restorative justice. Hebrews were doing it when it came to land disputes. You know, this is thousands of years ago, right? They had restorative practices. And so how is restorative justice different from retributive justice? Well, remember the questions that retributive justice asks, right? It asks, who broke the rule? How bad is it? And thus, what should the consequences be? And then we go, oh, it needs to be proportional, eye for an eye, that sort of thing. And it has all of these negative consequences that we talked about. Restorative justice asks three very different questions. It asks, who is hurt? What are their needs? And whose obligation is it to meet those needs, right? And I saw a piece of Danish research just a few months ago on kids. And kids have the ability to spontaneously generate restorative practices, restorative justice, right? So there's a kid steals a teddy bear, right? Kid who has the teddy bear stolen gets all upset and crying and shouting, right? And so what happens is, well, retributively, you go, oh, the kid broke the rule, he shouldn't steal a teddy bear. Well, how bad is that? Well, he's done it twice. Oh, that really deserves that kid to be beaten up. You know, you beat up the kid. And so what that does is you create more hurt, right? You respond to hurt by creating more hurt. And I don't know whether we're on this planet to do that to each other, Todd. And so I truly believe there is another moral appeal that we can live up to. Kids, instead of doing that, yeah, I mean, it's not that kids don't beat each other up. They do that too. But instead of beating the kid up, they find ways to do these restorative stuff. Who's hurt? Well, the kid whose teddy bear is stolen is hurting. Oh, what are their needs? Well, they want the teddy bear back. Well, whose obligation is it to meet that need? Well, the kid who stole it, right, with an apology. And so this is how they mediate their conflicts, right? And of course, I mean, this is nothing new. I mean, we got alternative dispute resolution, which is a well-developed field, and lots of organizations, particularly in healthcare, have adopted it. But it's organized around these three very different questions. And what really motivated me to write the Just Culture book is, and sorry that I'm blabbing on about this so much, but I feel passionate about this stuff, is what really motivated me was really two things. One is I can't stomach injustice. You know, I find it really, really morally outrageous and difficult to be sitting in the same room as a nurse who's lost her job because she was involved in an adverse event. And I don't think that's the way to deal with your fellow human beings who don't come to work to do a bad job. I think it is stupid in terms of the organizational learning, right? I think it's stupid in terms of the organizational culture. I know you had Ed Schein talking about that, right? And so, to see that injustice perpetrated on a relatively vulnerable human being who already is in a bad place because of their involvement in something that is opposite to why they come to work, which is to help people rather than hurt people, that certainly was one motivation. But the second motivation was a much more pragmatic one, and that is that I was tired of, or impatient. That's probably the better word. Impatient when increasingly I encountered managers in these sorts of organizations who had no idea that this was a possibility. It's not that they were evil people, because they're not evil people. They don't want to perpetrate injustices either. They don't come to work to be unjust, right? But it's that they didn't know. They had no idea, right? No idea about an alternative paradigm, about an alternative algorithm, about an alternative set of questions to ask and involve people around it, right? And so that's why I really burned for writing the third edition of Just Culture, to make that much more available to the community.
And that nuance, it's not even nuance, that's the wrong word. That change of the question is a powerful shift, really, in the overall philosophical approach to the idea of justness. I mean, that's the key. That's amazing. And it's interesting, you sort of tagged to it, but you're now the department chair. So you're moving from an academic understanding of justness to a daily interface around justness with members of your own department. For the other people listening to the podcast who've ever managed anything, you've never managed anything until you manage an department in the university. It's I'm not saying it's a bad thing, but I'm saying there are lots of people who have lots of ideas what is the right move forward, and none of them tend to agree. That's probably a good way to describe that, I think.
Oh, I love it. And there's a little bit more to it, which is the stakes are very low.
Yeah, right? Yeah, exactly. But do you think about that?
We're going to blow.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Yeah, you're not going to blow the world up. Do you think about that notion of justness when you think about being a department chair?
Oh, absolutely. And even when you're not thinking about it, I think it is implicit or implied in many, if not most, of the decisions that you make, right? What is the right thing to do? And though that is fundamentally an ethical question, and often a question about justice, right? What is the right thing to do with a long-serving member of staff who has some family issues and left a room of students unattended because of an emergency, right? The university gets all outraged because you've got kids paying for tuition and they show up for class and then nobody shows up, right? There's no replacement. There's no, because it all happened in such a messy way. And yet this is not because of evil intentions of people who work here, right? And so these are these sort of Solomon moments. You know, what is the right thing to do? How do you create justice in these situations? How do you do right by the students, by the kids? How do you do right by the university and their goals and constraints, right, in an economically more pressurized climate than it was? And how do you do right by the staff member, right? And for that matter, the colleagues around that staff, that faculty member. And so, I mean, that's just one example, right? Go ahead.
How do we change? So a lot of people have spent a lot of money and bought these just programs, because there's a lot of just culture people out there right now sort of selling their wares. You're probably not in a position to say this, but I could say for the most part, they're sort of selling, you know, the culpability metrics, kind of Jim Reason's thinking around that. But they think they've bought the right answer. In fact, they think they're doing the right thing. They've got the algorithm, and by God, they're using it. How do we have that conversation to move them towards this restorative notion of justice?
Well, if that is indeed where we want to impel the communities, you know, that they would have to move to restorative justice, Let me answer it at several levels here,
okay,
Todd, because it's a critical question, obviously, because I'm sure that many of the listeners are either have been engaged in discussions with people who believe they really can genuinely offer a solution or a way forward on this stuff. Justice is one of those essentially contested categories. What that means in social science is that you can put smart people in a room who are well-informed, who have a rational discussion, and still come out of that room after a day of deliberations with many different kinds of opinions about what justice means, right? That is, it is one of those categories in which it is fundamentally impossible to get consensus. What is just to one is unjust to another, right? And so, and that's not going to go away, neither with me pontificating something or with somebody offering an algorithm, right? I think we have to understand that there is an immensely complex landscape around this where what some people believe is just, others will vilify as simplified and unjust. I do believe that if companies embrace a particular kind of justice, be it the retributive kind, for example, then that says something about either how informed they are about alternative viewpoints, which is, again, is why the book is such, I think, hopefully an important contributor to the debate, or it truly says something about them. It says something about their culture. It says something about their managerialism, the way they think they should govern, right? And again, I'm not impugning that, saying it is wrong, because who am I to say is wrong? But I think it says something about, sorry, let me, let's see, here we go.
Is that your phone?
Yeah, that's one of the phones. Yeah. This is what, sorry. Like,
oh, I loved it.
Oh, man, this is what department chairs get. Lots of calls and emails and it's, anyway, forgive me. So,
you are completely forgiven, my friend.
Thank you. So there are many ways to create justice, some less imperfect than others, but they're all imperfect, right? I mean, whatever justice you try to create, it's like democracy, right? It's always an approximation. You can never have the perfect model. It doesn't work that way. Life and the world and people's intentions and perspectives are too complex for that.
And yet, I hear you completely, and yet what I think is so interesting is that I think we're going to have to build a bridge from one form of justice, the retributive form of justice, towards sort of a more mature understanding of justice that moves in a different direction.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm powerfully impacted by the fact that the notion of restoration is so powerful for an organization that's had a problem. So if you go into an organization that's had a catastrophic failure, a fatality or something horrible, you really want to restore that organization's ability to do high risk work better than when they had the event. And you won't punish them into getting better. You really can only restore them. You know, who was hurt? Mm. How can we learn from this? What's our path forward?
Yeah.
It's pretty powerful. Yeah. Is that moving you? Because I know you've got another book, this End of Heaven book. I can't even wait for it. I'm so bummed I didn't get to pre-read it. What's it do?
Well, first of all, forgive me for it. I think I did tell the publisher to involve you in pre-reading it, Todd, and ask for your opinion on whether they should publish it at all. And so I don't know what they were expecting from you if you didn't get it.
But, yeah,
so that book, so the End of Heaven, which should come out either the end of this year or early next year, is. The subtitle is—I don't even know what the subtitle is. Let me see. I have it somewhere. Disaster and Suffering in a Scientific Age is the subtitle.
Wow, that's great.
And so what it does, what really motivated me to write that book, and I know I write them quicker than most people can read them, but that's okay because I don't read them either. Right? So that should. That should be a consolation. Oh, Decker doesn't read his own book, so I don't even read it either. Yeah, I'll just look at the YouTube video of it, right? Which I haven't got for the End of Heaven yet, by the way. For Just Culture, I do. But what I have begun to find increasingly fascinating and intriguing, Todd, is the double-edged sword that our scientific age really is, right? You could claim that we are smarter than we've ever been before, right? That we can see further, into the universe, that we can mold the future in ways that we believe we should be doing, that we can, you know, the we can extend life by many years relative to 80 or 100 years ago. And so we're really smart at this. We're really good. And yet misfortune, disaster continues to vex us, right? It continues to raise existential questions that science is just not very good at answering, sometimes not even good at asking, right? And so, and in some sense, these existential questions about the meaning of our existence, why is it so easy to get it snuffed out? And why is it so unfair? Why is it the good pilots who fly into the mountainside, right? Why is it always the good guys who topple over in a crane into a ditch and drown, right? Why is it there's often this sense of as I said, deep unfairness with the capriciousness of misfortune, the arbitrariness of disaster. Why is it kids that die in a particular collapse of a building somewhere, right? Or innocent seamstresses, or and so these are not people who did anything wrong, right? Now, for millennia, we've had, of course, many religious scripts giving us beautiful explanations of this, right? And well, beautiful, that's debatable, but at least many explanations for this, until you get to the Enlightenment and Voltaire and other people in the 17th and 18th centuries who start questioning that and say, what do you mean? These kids had to die because they were somehow sinners, or they were somehow guilty of something that required punishment or needed them to be made into an example? Well, many people don't accept that explanation any longer, right? And it's not that I'm impugning that explanation per se, right? Because again, humanity is hugely complex in how it generates explanation for dealing with inexplicable and difficult things. So what I wanted to do in this book, and I think I have done, is explore how this looks in a scientific age or an increasingly secular age. And so what that means is, or what I found, and that's pretty intuitive, I think, is that, or perhaps not, that the scientific explanations for disaster increasingly leave us even more vexed rather than less vexed. And let me explain that. When you look at the past 70 years, but certainly the last 30 years of human factors research, right? And this includes work by Jim Reason that you mentioned earlier. One of the very obvious statements that research makes is that bad things have multiple causes, right? It's not just one thing. It's not just one person who made an error. It's not just one root cause, right? That's an illusion, right? This is something we have to understand, that complex events, complex disasters have complex causes, and are caused by all kinds of things. And very often, the science shows, these things are not very different from how we create success. They're very closely related to the normal daily running of our messy organizations, right? And so when we do our science, our disaster science, well, we actually create even more tension, because what do we say to the people who suffered, right? What do we say to the people who lost loved ones, who were affected one way or another by the disaster? Well, what can science offer? Science can offer, oh, this disaster had 23 causes and 136 contributing factors, and right? Okay, and what are the recommendations going to be? Well, we have to improve the organization's safety culture. I mean, what consolation does that offer, right? Very little, very little. And so science has much smartness to offer, but very little solace, right? And this is where I think the epistemological question, as in what happened, that question, diverges ever more from the existential one. Why did this happen? What does this mean? Right. And the book, in part, is an attempt. I think it's feeble and incomplete, but at least it launches the debate to try to make those two talk to each other. Right. Am I making any sense, or tons, would this book suck?
This is so interesting to me, because it's the meeting place between the existential crisis and the technical crisis. It's the meeting place between why and how, right? I mean, why did this happen? Why does God let bad things happen to good people? And then how do bad things happen to good people? And that meeting point in the middle, I think, is really significant and important. Why don't you come to the United States and hang out with us? Let me not be so ethnocentric. why don't you come to North America? why don't you come out to North America and hang out with us? Do you have a trip? I mean, why don't you come over here? Anything in the works in your mind?
So being a department chair means I don't own my own calendar anymore, Todd.
Yeah, yeah. However,
I have found, I mean, yeah, it's
well, I was going to say, speaking of existential strife, and we were, yeah, exactly.
Nah, I wouldn't call it existential. That's more practical or impractical, as the case may be. However, yes. So what a wonderful way to, actually, that's a good question. Why don't we start thinking about that? In fact,
let me toss one out to you. Why don't we do a meeting on the West Coast or the East Coast or the Middle Coast or someplace. We do an open meeting where people can just hang out and limit it to, I don't know, 30 or 50, no more than 50 people, where people can just kind of hang out, and we do a deep dive day, kind of starting at the beginning and moving towards this end of heaven thesis. So anyone can come. And everyone is welcome. Let's say that, because that seems like the right thing to say. And we do a meeting. Does that interest you? Would that be fun?
That would be so cool. That would be really cool. And to see who shows up.
Yeah,
right? That would be very cool. And
we could do that. And do you want to do one? Do you want to do one on each coast? Do you want to do one? Well, maybe we should see if there's any interest.
While we're at it. Yeah. Can I fill a room? I don't know, Todd. I've only written like 11 books or something. But again, I don't read them either. So,
if we have the executive deli tray for lunch, I can almost guarantee a room to fill. That's pretty much all I take.
You just made my ego shrink back.
Sorry.
No, that's okay. This is a good thing. My children would otherwise do it for you.
I think that's why they like me.
There's many reasons.
Is that possible? Because that would be a fun thing to do, because it's been a while since you've been here. And quite honestly, when you're here, you're often tied up in rather exclusive things where, you know, where people like the guy who's working, you know, DevOps for Etsy may not have the chance to come and see you, or the nurse in Houston, or the pilot SkyWest.
I get is working the rope line, right?
Yeah.
And then do the exclusive talk. If we did kind of an open forum, the
open participation meeting, I think that would be really a fun thing to do.
So talk about just culture, talk about second victim, scientific understandings of disaster versus existential questions that they raise.
I would even take you back a little bit and say, start with talking about the field guide, and talk about not necessarily about the field guide, but how the field guide sort of helps set the stage for the discussions to change, and how it diffused out, and how, you know, we really weren't having the just culture discussions until after the field guide had some impact, just kind of move from there. So that anyone's welcome. I mean, you wouldn't need to be an expert in a Deckeran understanding of the universe. You just need to be a person who is interested in, you know, a restorative culture low amount of existential strife, he says.
Yeah, whatever low means.
Yeah, I don't. It's hard to measure that.
That would be so cool. So what are you thinking? When? What?
So
I need to talk to my PA, obviously.
Yeah. But
let's
Think May. May's a good time.
It's spring, and it's not spring here then.
Yeah, it's a perfect time for you. I didn't even think about that. But it's before the summer starts, so before the summer rush. We could probably get together. I think it's a great idea. Let's see if we can do it. That'll be perfect. I'll make some calls on this side and see if I can get some people interested. And then we'll just kind of put out an invitation. I like the idea.
Lovely.
Would that be something you'd like to do? I mean,
All for it.
I want to give you a chance. Maybe a better way to say this is I want to give just the average Joe and Jane, the practitioner, a chance to kind of just sit and and have a dialogue with you, you know, a conversation kind of.
Oh, absolutely. And Todd, it's, I find it, I mean, it's, to talk about average Joe and Jane is incredibly arrogant and I think wrongly pitched.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, not impugning the way you say, but because I love you anyway, but the issue is that guys like you and I, right, we need to have these conversations because ultimately all of the ideas we come up with are not worth anything if they are not flowing through the hands of people who meet this stuff every day, right, and have to make those calls. And so to support them in that, to have those conversations, to take, as you say, a deep dive and show some of the depth and scholarship behind it,
yeah.
I think is extremely worthwhile.
I like it.
And it surely may motivate ideas for yet or inspire ideas for yet another book.
Plus, I think it'd be really fun. I think people would it would be fun. Yeah. They'd really enjoy it immensely. And let's make a deal. Let's push forward in this. And towards the end of the year, first of next year, come back and talk more about the End of Heaven book. Will you do that? I would really like that, actually.
Yeah. That would be very cool.
When it starts rolling out, let's do some more talk on that. But let me send the charge out right now. Let's do one of these open meetings and see who's interested in going to this and see if we can just do it. I think it's a good idea.
Wonderful.
Thank you, my friend. Did we miss anything exciting? Anything important? Anything we should have said we didn't say?
No, I don't think there's always more, but you know, there's limits to what you can cram into a podcast. So,
that's right. Yeah. And I try to never,
I'll
hook you up. I try to never make the podcast longer than their drive to work. That's kind of my rule.
I don't drive to work. I ride to work, and listening to a podcast on the bike is a bad idea.
Yeah. Not the best idea, but they're perfect in planes where they make their money. Podcasts make their money in planes. It is the perfect thing to do in a plane. It's perfect.
Even in the cockpit, but that would probably not make friends either. Tell me about it.
Thank you so much, man.
My pleasure, Todd. Thank you. Talk later.
Indeed. So that took an interesting turn there at the end. I just boldly ask him, because what's he going to say? No, he's on the pod. I mean, I guess he could have said no. He didn't, though. And after we talked, and before I recorded this ending, we went ahead and hammered out some time, and we have a couple-week period in May when he's actually available to come over. And so if you're interested, maybe Leslie and I'll pick up some time and see if we can have a little meeting someplace and invite some people if they want to come and spend some time. That's available. And if you want us to come and spend some time with you guys at your company, we could probably do that too. I mean, we talked about all those things. And the way it looks like it's going to be myself and Professor Decker, we'll hang out and kind of have a full day workshop of just some really interesting and fun stuff. We've done it before. We've done these actually several times in places other than North America. It'd be fun to do it here in North America. And I think you would love to come along. I mean, you know you're invited. I'll always pull up another chair for you and make it happen. So if you're interested, well, tell me, because then I'll know if you're interested and we can make it go from there. Until then, listen to this one a couple times. All that stuff on restorative justice and this book, The End of Heaven, I'm really interested in this place. We've talked about it a bunch. The entire time I've been on this ride, I've been talking about the tension between free agency of a worker and predeterminism, and that's kind of right where this is as well. So we'll see what happens on this. Thanks for the podcast. Thanks for your time. As always, learn something new every single day. I bet you did today. Have as much fun as you possibly can, and for goodness sakes, be safe.